weapon, a militia, personal militia of the dictator, the wannabe dictator, and also the what we're not talking about, the intimidation of judges. Last week or a few weeks ago, they burned the house of one of the judges. We must hold the line and protect each other. Mobilization, organizing, and not giving them an inch in the courts, in the streets, in legislative bodies, wherever we need to fight, we're going to fight back.
And Leah Greenberg, I mean, as you mentioned, these are not just nationwide protests. They're actually also global. So if you could tell us what are the cities where you think the protests will be biggest, and then your guidance to protesters about how to keep safe this weekend as these protests go on.
Absolutely. Well, it's hard for me to say where I think it's going to be biggest. I think we are going to have enormous protests in many of the big cities across America. I also think that I can't emphasize enough how incredible we are seeing these smaller protests in places where there has never been a protest before. We are hearing about, you know, dozens of protests across Montana and West Virginia and North Dakota. People are coming out in neighborhoods that maybe have never protested before because they are so activated. They might not have ever been political before, but they are activated by what is happening in this country right now, and they know they have to show up. And in terms of safety and security, we take this incredibly seriously. We've been working very closely with hosts across the country who are organizing these protests to make sure that everybody is trained in safety and de-escalation, has a safety plan, that there are marshals on hand when needed. And if folks are interested in security and safety training, then they can go to our website, nokings.org. We have safety protocols for folks to participate.
Leah, we have to leave it there, but we will cover these protests, of course, bring it to folks on Monday. Leah Greenberg, co-executive director of Indivisible, part of Saturday's No Kings protest, and Byron Sikcha Lopez, older person for Chicago's 25th Ward. That does it for the show. I'll be at the Lensic Theater tonight in Santa Fe for the Santa Fe International Film Festival with a showing of the film About Democracy Now, Steal the Story, Please. Tomorrow at the Woodstock Film Festival at 3:00 at Woodstock Playhouse. I'm Amy Goodman with Noreen Sheikh.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are stressed, worried, or just feeling down when they call or text 988. Support is confidential, and call takers are real people in Oregon who speak with understanding and respect. More info at 988oregon.org.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim.
Welcome to the Project Censored Radio Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your co-host Eleanor Goldfield along with Mickey Huff. In the first part of the program this week, I welcome back to the show U.S. Marine veteran Matthew Ho to talk about the realities versus the stories of the U.S. military. How much does that oath to defend the Constitution really mean in practice? We look at Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth's recent performance and how this relates to the hierarchy of complicity within the higher-ranking military brass. Matt and I also give some historical context to the use of the U.S. military as a domestic police force and how Hollywood and the stories that we consume as Americans bolster these ideas of a top-down restorative violence, affecting how we think about the idea of the world's largest military taking over our streets. Next up, author Danny Goldberg joins the show to talk about his most recent book, Liberals with Attitude, The Rodney King Beating and the Fight for the Soul of Los Angeles. Danny discusses how this history can serve us in the present, how building coalitions with those we disagree with is critical work, and how using the media, even legacy media, can support our grassroots aims. All this and more coming up now on Project Censored.
Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love. We're
Thanks, everyone, for joining us at the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your co-host, Eleanor Goldfield, along with Mickey Huff. And we're very glad to welcome back onto the program Matthew Ho, who's the Associate Director of the Eisenhower Media Network and an Emeritus Senior Fellow with the Center for International Policy. He is a disabled Marine Corps combat veteran, and in 2009, Matt resigned his post with the State Department in Afghanistan in protest over the escalation of that war. Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Eleanor. It's good to see you and be here with you.
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. And I wanted to start off here, Matt, with a line that I found at a post over at usconstitution.net, and it's run by constitutional analysts. Quote, every American military officer swears an oath that begins with 10 critical words. I do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States. Not the president, not the party in power, not the Secretary of Defense, the Constitution. And in that piece, they go on to outline why this distinction is an important one, not least of all, thanks to current head of the War Department, Pete Hegseth's recent theatrics. But I also know from experience in our lovely land of the free that what's in writing or in speeches often chafes with the lived realities and indeed expectations of those in power. So, Matt, I was wondering if you could start off by describing from your experience and expertise, is the military oath in practice as pure as perhaps the authors suggest that it's meant to be?
I don't think it is, just because I think for the vast majority of the millions upon millions of men and women who've been in the military, that oath never really becomes a real thing, right? They're never really tested by some crucible or some challenge that requires them to examine who their obedience is towards, where their allegiance lies. So I think for most people, it's an academic, or maybe it's intellectual. Certainly, I think there are times that, you know, men and women in the military will have discussions with peers, and they will get into that type of more, again, abstract philosophical aspects of their service. But, you know, for most men and women in the U.S. military, it's no different than men and women working anywhere. You're there doing a job, you got your day to day, you're just trying to get through the day without something burning down. How are you going to get and pick up the dog from the groomers at the same time as getting your kids from soccer practice or whatever, right? I mean, so for most people, but there are some, you know, and particularly you get to the higher ranks. And I should say, this is the same oath that all members of the U.S. government take. So if you're a judge or a lawyer being sworn in, you know, any role. When I joined the State Department, this was the oath I took. Park rangers take this oath, you know, so on and so forth. So the aspects of it, though, you know, again, going past this idea of where's your allegiance? Is it to a person, an institution? No, it's to this document, to the Constitution. And that, of course, then is very abstract, right? That is very much, okay, it's to a piece of paper that exists in the archives, right? You know that. But the meaning of that then is that, no, it's just not just to the Constitution as drafted by Jimmy Madison. It's to the entire body of law. It's to a republic based upon the rule of law, and that you must follow all the legal aspects of the institutions to which you belong to. So I think having that understanding of where their obedience and allegiance needs to be, again, not just to, certainly not to a man, not to an institution, and not to some document, you know, the piece of paper sitting in the archives, but to the actual body of law that governs their institutions and their conduct. And I think this is why so many people are upset at the military in terms of their relationship with Donald Trump, where they are not acting in obedience or allegiance to the Constitution, and they're certainly not acting in obedience or allegiance to the precedent set by things such as the Nuremberg trials, right? You know, that established a clear, well, international body of law that we are bound to through our Constitution, right? We are bound to international law, to any treaties that we sign or become a part of. But then the other aspect too is the ethos of it, right? I mean, so there's a whole other aspect of this aside from the semantic legal aspect, but rather an ethos and a morality, professionalism that's required to be followed as well.
Yeah, and I want to dig into that a little bit, because getting a little bit more into the Hegseth theatrics, he brought up the quote-unquote warrior ethos, which, again, there's a whole conversation about the toxicity of warrior ethos as the world's largest empire, but on its face here, Hegseth was suggesting that officers should avoid politics that oppose Trump administration priorities while enthusiastically implementing politics that support them. Now, the counterargument to that, of course, is that, you know, the warrior ethos, quote unquote, is about commitment to a mission, resilience under adversity, and loyalty to fellow soldiers. It's not about unquestioning obedience to political leaders or abandoning constitutional principles in favor of ideological purity, quote unquote. But I have a few questions about that. First of all, isn't the president the commander-in-chief of the armed forces? So isn't it kind of your job to do what he says? And as someone who has been in war zones where clearly the goal was not to uphold international law, was not to uphold the Constitution, but rather bolster U.S. hegemony, and indeed ideological purity of U.S. exceptionalism, what's your read on what Hegseth is demanding? I mean, is it just a case of saying the quiet part loud? Is that why it's problematic?
Well, I think, you know, that aspect of Hegseth first, you know, these are men and women in power now who see themselves as revolutionaries. You know, these are men and women who see themselves in power as being brought here. Some of them believe they're on a divine mission, and they sincerely believe that. I think we would say they're not revolutionaries, they're reactionaries, but they view themselves as a revolutionary, and that's what's so important, right? It doesn't what we think matters, but it really matters what they think, you know, how they, right? I mean, so, you know, he sees himself as, Hegseth sees himself as necessarily rebuilding, fixing, purifying the American military into the force of arms that America, he may believe, once had, but he believes also as well that it needs for the current and coming challenges. The idea of going towards a white Christian patriarchal military is what they want. He's genuinely invested in this idea of the warrior ethos, as you were speaking of. And that's a very mythological, fictionalized type of thing. And it, that warrior ethos, the way Hegseth and those like him believe it to be, is opposed by a professional ethos. So the warrior ethos, as Hegseth describes, when it comes into being, when it's actually enacted, it results in war crimes, it results in atrocities, it results in kill anything that move policies. The Israeli army in Gaza has a warrior ethos in the matter in which Pete Hegseth believes in. And that is in contradiction to the professional ethos. So you have maybe a barbaric or a mythological or a wannabe warrior ethos that you can juxtapose against the professional military ethos, which is one of a professional warrior. And I know this is going to sound ridiculous based upon the evidence and history of the American military, but at least what it's taught in the schools, and this is a whole other thing we can get into them, right? About the whole folly of warfare, the whole ridiculousness of believing that you can have this professionalism in something that's one superhuman like war, where war, no matter how moral and ethical and guided by professionalism you think you are, that you're going to be your own agent in it. War is going to make you an agent of its purposes, right? So Hegseth's belief in this war ethos, when it comes out, what does it look like? It looks like melee, right? I mean, it looks like massacre. It looks like atrocity. It looks like Gaza. And so getting back to this idea of him wanting to cull the military, he wants to chase people out. He wants women to leave. He wants minorities to leave. And they don't care that women and minorities make up half of the U.S. military. If you were to say to them, what are you going to do? Well, we'll just bring in more people. We'll recruit more soldiers. We'll have technology. We'll use mercenaries. They have ways in their minds for how they could have a military of less than a million that to them would be more effective, that to them would be more lethal, that to them would be more efficient, and certainly it would also be, in some of their greater desires, more pure, right? So when you see Hegseth up there speaking about these types of things, he's not saying things where he doesn't know what the consequences are. And the point about the generals sitting there quietly, they are okay with this. Many of them are men and women who are close to retirement anyway. At that speech in Quantico, you know, many of them, understand I've only got a year or two or three before I retire anyhow, so I can get through this. You know, that's just if they even care. Many of them don't care. Many of them aren't aligned with what Hegseth is thinking. You know, the American generalships, the flag officers, it's always been politicized. It always has been. So it's men and women who've known how to climb the career ladder. You know, once you get to be a colonel or a captain in a Navy, it's very much all political. You know, that type of intra-institution knife fighting to get to those few type spots, well, these are the men and women who made it through that. These are the men and women who won. And so their instincts, as well as their experiences and their skills to do such things, if they say they just have to salute and follow Hegseth, then so be it to get to the next level. You know, but then the other thing too is that these are not men and women who are going to act out of any sense of morality. These are men and women who are not going to act out of any sense of, you know, professional ethos or any type of adherence to the rule of law. If they were, they would have spoken out about Trump and Hegseth firing many of their peers for reasons of race, sex, and politics. They would have spoken out when the Judicial Advocacy General Corps lost its entire leadership. So the lawyers for the Pentagon were fired very quickly by Hegseth. They would have spoken out when General C.Q. Brown was fired as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for no reason given. You could have given a reason. You could have said, look, United States, we lost this battle in the Red Sea to the Yemenis. We've got to fire somebody for that. I think a lot of people would actually kind of be relieved by that. Wow, there's some accountability going on here. But no, there was no reason given. So C.Q. Brown being fired. And, you know, the only thing you can look, when you look back at what have these people said before, well, you know, you see Hegseth saying things like C.Q. Brown is a diversity hire. So was C.Q. Brown fired as the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff strictly because he was black? I believe so, you know, and all the evidence points to that. And not one general admiral said, this is wrong. If Brown's out, I'm out too. You've had the extrajudicial killing of civilians in boats in the Caribbean. You know, that we could find all other kinds of ways the U.S. is breaking its own laws as well as international laws with its military. But just for example, the spectacular murders of people carried out by the U.S. military, no generals or admirals have said, this is wrong, I'm not going along with it. And then, of course, we've had American soldiers, whether it's Federalized National Guard or active duty Marines, being placed into American cities where they are supporting the detention, the brutalization, the humiliation of American citizens, of legal residents, and immigrants. And again, no American general admiral has said anything. No American general admiral is saying anything about troops going to Chicago right now, right? I mean, like, and what that's fraught with. One, just the constitutional legal aspects. Does the president have the power to do this, to mobilize something like this? But also, too, the danger of it. You're bringing troops from another area, from another state, to police another part of the country. Like, that sounds like a recipe for civil war, doesn't it? Like, shouldn't these men and women who are in uniform be saying, look, I've read a lot of history and I know how this type of thing can go? You know, no, they're not. They're all going along with it. So you had, particularly last week after Hegseth's speech, where the general sat there impassively and didn't show emotion, that's more or less what they're supposed to do. If people ever watch the State of the Union address, the Joint Chiefs will sit there emotionless. And people reading into it is that some form of defiance. Oh, well, great. If that's it, if that was their fines, their theatrics there, then we are cooked. We will know where the American military lies, because their silence was obedience. Their silence was complicity. Trump even gave them an out. Trump said, if you don't agree with me, get up and walk out. And those are men and women, every one of them. If you're a general, you're retiring with like about $150,000 a year retirement pay. You know, it's about that probably for them, averaging it out, plus all other kinds of opportunities.
I just want to remind our listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio, and I am your co-host, Eleanor Goldfield, and we are speaking with Marine Corps combat veteran Matthew Ho.
I mean, it seems to me that the culture is one of this blind obedience, this kind of individualistic, like, well, I fought my way to get to this high appointed space, I'm gonna stay here and it's not that big of a deal, I'll leave soon. And also that this ask or this demand, this overt demand to commit war crimes, is it kind of one of those things where it's like the military is like, well, we were kind of doing that thing anyway, so I guess we'll just keep on doing what we've been doing.
Right. Again, and these are men and women then who were in Quantico, maybe the most junior one in there, say a one-star general, maybe has only 22 years in the military. Maybe. That would be extreme. You know, usually they have at least 25 years or more. And then when you're talking about the 3- and 4-star general, these are all men and women who have been in for over 30 years. And the same thing, too, with the senior enlisted advisors that were there, the command sergeant majors, the sergeant majors from the Marine Corps. But like, these are all men and women who have been in the service for, at that point, over 30 years. Right. So the point about that is that these are all soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines that went through the Iraq and Afghan wars and stayed in. They stayed silent. And any supposed lessons they learned, or, you know, that maybe they were junior officers or junior troops at the time, at the height of the Iraq war, and they said, you know, when they were majors or when they were gunnery sergeants or whatnot, I'm not going to do this when I'm, you know, if I'm still in, I'm not going to go along with this. I mean, I had that happen when I was in the Marines, like when I was an officer in the late 90s, particularly say 1998, when I was a second lieutenant going through my officer training in Quantico. And I mean, the number of colonels and generals, because, you know, you had plenty of Marines who were still senior officers and enlisted who had been in Vietnam, you know, and so you had one after another. They'd say things like, again, this is 1998. You have colonels and generals and sergeant major say, you know, we're never going to fight a war like that again. We're never going to fight a landlocked war. We're never going to have another Vietnam. And then, you know, a few years later, we had two, you know. I mean, so when it comes down to it, you could see not just by the silent obedience that we saw on display in Quantico, but also as well their lack of action in these last 10 months. Why should we believe they're going to do anything differently?
Yeah, so much for that mythological war ethos.
Yeah, and it's disturbing because I feel like, particularly on liberal blogs and liberal podcasts and TV shows, there's this assumption that the generals are going to save us, right? I'm sure if we went and pulled open a copy of The Atlantic or something like that, there's at least one article how the generals are going to save us because they didn't clap during Hegseth's speech last month, right? Last week. You mean like, so, yeah, I mean, the delusion of the liberal class in this country. Yeah, it's
pretty strong. I mean, it's the same way that, you know, we're saved because the Democratic members of Congress wore pink to Trump's first State of the Union.
Right, right. That did it. That so, really showed
everyone
him.
We just need to wear more pink.
Yeah, yeah. I just did, not to go on a tangent, but I just had a friend of mine say, from overseas, say, so if all these people in the U.S. and Democratic Party who are now saying that I told you so, I knew how bad Trump was, how come they're not prepared to do anything about it? Right. So if you honestly knew 2 years ago how bad Trump was going to be and you're in the Democratic Party in some form of leadership capacity, how come you didn't do anything about it? How come you didn't prepare better? How come you didn't come up with a plan? You know,
yeah.
Except for we're going to wear pink, you know, or
that Kamala Harris was your choice.
Well, that's a whole other thing.
And I want to shift to talk a little bit about, because you mentioned the National Guard, and of course, as listeners might be aware, I mean, we're recording this on Wednesday, October 8th, so some things might happen between now and this coming Monday in Chicago and indeed elsewhere, but I want to talk about the kind of context here. And here at Project Censored, we're very aware of the importance of history and contextualizing our present and influencing our future. So the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878 restricts using federal military forces for domestic law enforcement. The law emerged from Reconstruction era concerns about military occupation of southern states and federal troops enforcing civil authority. And it establishes that military forces exist to defend against foreign threats, not to police American citizens. Except, because there's always that except, in extraordinary circumstances where the Insurrection Act allows the president to deploy troops to suppress rebellion or enforce federal authority when states cannot. Now, of course, there's a lot of gray and vague area here. The president just seems to be at leisure to decide when those extraordinary circumstances are. And here's the thing. Some of us might agree with prior use, i.e. Eisenhower used it in 1957 to enforce school desegregation in Little Rock. The issue is still that there is but a paltry 1878 legislative line between the military pointing their guns out versus in. And so here again, Matt, I'd like to pick your brain on how this shows up on the inside. Is there an understanding of this line? Is it seen as a big deal to cross it?
Well, I think, for most men and women in the military, it's something that would never have occurred to them. And certainly they're, you know, facing outward. They're not facing inward. Many of them are stationed abroad. And certainly the work that they do is to support efforts abroad, wars, incursions, invasions, occupations, right? I mean, there's so little introspection about that, let alone, right, this idea that maybe possibly we would be told to, but the history of it is so scant, right, to be fair, the role of, like, say, the active duty military, but then, of course, incorporate the Federalized National Guard in roles like this, it's scant for those who haven't studied history as deeply as yourself or I would assume probably most of the listeners of this program. So the idea that guard troops have been used to put down strikes, right? You know, they've been brought in to put down riots, things like that, often in circumstances where a little bit of hindsight and you say, my God, that was really oppressive. That was really disgusting. That was really un-American what was done there, you know, utilized for crass political purposes to either repress urban protest or workers protesting, right? I mean, so, you know, within the military, though, again, it's simply not something that would come up. But for the senior officers, this is something that they should be aware of and they should be contemplative of, whether it's like the strictly legal aspect of this. Look, the U.S. military is not supposed to be a police force. There needs to be an insurrection or some extraordinary circumstance. In, say, the case in 57 with Eisenhower, the extraordinary circumstance was you had a state that was refusing the orders of the Supreme Court. And that you also had, Eisenhower originally intended to use the National Guard and said he ended up having sent active duty soldiers there. But he did so because the Guard refused to accept mobilization from the federal government. So you had insubordination. You had mutiny. You had insurrection. That's a war we fought already. You know, I mean, we fought that in the 1860s, this concept of states' rights. And the result was it doesn't exist except as through a federalized system where there is a hierarchy. What you have here, I don't think anyone reasonable looks at this and says that there's extraordinary circumstances or that's an insurrection. And certainly statements that come out of this administration are, you know, exaggerated, hyperbolic, ludicrous, insane. You know, I mean, the statements from Trump say about Oregon, which is where this, you know, where he also wants to send soldiers into Portland, wants to bring them up from California. And, you know, that as we speak is quelled right now, or at least it's in limbo, I guess. But, you know, his descriptions of Portland sounds like it's Stalingrad 1943. Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. And it sounds like a post-apocalyptic film. And that's something we could do a whole show on, the role of Hollywood in shaping our culture, shaping our society to make it such that you need the American military to come in to save the day. I remember there was this terrible Matthew McConaughey movie from 25, 30, maybe 30 years ago, where he's fighting dragons, like dragons come and they destroy the world. And then, like, it's a terrible, terrible movie. But it's among other things, you know, is, I think it was called Reign of Fire. Reign, R-E-I-G-N, right?
Duh.
Right, exactly. Everything about it was just stomach turning. And I watched it because I was like, okay, cool. Here's Matthew McConaughey fighting dragons. And it was just so lame. But and particularly at the end, because what saves at the end is a militarized force, right? You know, we just need bigger guns. We need to put together in a more orderly fashion, put a guy in charge, and then we'll fight and beat these dragons. You know, I mean, so, but for many Americans, though, this idea, that this thought, this narrative that what we need to have to restore order, to protect people for some type of justice and peace is some type of restorative violence, right? So both this myth of restorative violence and redemptive violence dominate American society. It dominates our storytelling. It dominates our myths. It dominates our narratives. It makes up so much of who we are. We're getting ready for the 250th anniversary of this country. Hopefully there will be, well, it's not going to happen, but you would like to think there'd be some really great examinations of it, you know, really pull apart what we understand about what was life. Why, you know, 250 years ago, did less than a third of the people in the colonies support independence? Why was that? You know, what was going on? And you know, so all that, again, a whole other show. But
I feel like you and I need to have a solid other podcast examining films like Independence Day and
Oh gosh, yeah. I remember going to see that in a theater.
Oh, yeah, me too. Well, and I think I remember going, or at least I saw it once with a Swedish friend who was like, "This is dumb," and I was like, "This is awesome," and I was like, Then I had some reflection, like, "Why do I think this is awesome?"
well, Independence Day is so amazing because it blends two things, right? And I'm talking about the one from 1995, not the more recent remake.
Oh, I didn't even know there was a remake.
Because there was a remake, and the U.S. military, the Department of Defense, now the Department of War, was heavily involved with that as a recruiting effort.
Nice.
And there was all vehicles and mechanisms in place with the film to push kids to the recruiting station. But with the 195, it is this blend of our own technology plus citizen soldiers save us from the aliens. And aliens can be interchangeable, whether they're from, you know, Mars or they're, that guy's got brown skin and I think I heard him say amigo, you know, or something, right? I mean, like, you know, I mean, like that kind of thing. Like, you have these understandings of who we are as a people, particularly on the right. And that's all that matters. What do they believe? What do they understand? How does everything that Trump, Kristi Noem, Stephen Miller, Pete Hegseth, these demagogues, how does that resonate with the people that they are talking to? You know, not to you and I, right? But to the people that they are talking to. How does it resonate? I mean, you see this recruitment effort for ICE, and I think the same thing will be done for the National Guard, where they will get the people that they want. They will get the brutes that exist among us who, you know, for multiple reasons, oh, I should have pulled it up, that had it ready. Understanding by Fyodor Dostoevsky about how blood and power are intoxicating. But you read that and you see certainly not just the senior leaderships, not just the Stephen Millers and the Pam Bondis, you know, these cruel sadists that are in power now, but you see the people that will follow them, that will join them. And so this current ICE expansion, I have no doubt they're going to get the people that they need. You know, National Guard as well. Maybe their numbers, supposedly National Guard recruitment's gone up, and maybe over time those numbers will decline as women and minorities say, you know, this isn't for me. But certainly they will get plenty of white men and women who look at what happened in Chicago, look what happened in Portland, look what happened in Washington, D.C. And they say, that's exactly what needs to be done. You know, that's, and I want to be a part of it.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, there's so many different threads to go on here, like the gamification of this stuff and how everyone gets to live their Hollywood ideal and how Hollywood is so complicit and how the Pentagon has bragged about how much influence they have in Hollywood.
Oh, God,
there are so many threads we could go on here. But alas, we are restricted by the clock. So, Matt, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us and talk about this from the inside of the military, as you do so well and powerfully. Where's a good place for folks to check out the work that you do with the Eisenhower Media Center?
Mostly my Substack. That's probably the best place to go to. So just my name, Matthew Ho, on Substack. Last name spelled H-O-H. I'm on Twitter as well, Matthew P. Ho, P as in Patrick, H-O-H. And then, of course, you can go to the Eisenhower Media Network's webpage as well and find us there.
Okay. Thank you so much, Matt. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Eleanor.
You are listening to the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio, and I'm your co-host, Eleanor Goldfield, along with Mickey Huff. Coming up next on the show, I sit down with Danny Goldberg, the author of Liberals with Attitude, The Rodney King Beating and the Fight for the Soul of Los Angeles. That's coming up right now, so please stay with us. Thanks, everyone, for joining us at the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio. I am your co-host, Eleanor Goldfield. We're very glad right now to be joined by Danny Goldberg, who's the author of 6 books, including the one that we're here to discuss today, Liberals with Attitude, The Rodney King Beating and the Fight for the Soul of Los Angeles. He was the chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California from 1987 to 1994, during which the events described in this latest book took place. He's a political activist and serves on the boards of Public Citizen, New Jewish Narrative, and Brave New Films. And he is currently the president of Gold Village Entertainment, having worked in the music business since the early 1970s. As a personal manager of Nirvana, Sonic Youth, Bonnie Raitt, the Allman Brothers and Steve Earle, among others. And he also served as president of three major record companies, Atlantic, Warner Brothers, and Mercury. Danny, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Well, absolutely. And thank you for writing this. Again, it's called Liberals with Attitude, The Rodney King Beating and the Fight for the Soul of Los Angeles by Akashic Books. And I wanted to start with a little bit of context. And as somebody who has filmed the police many a time, in reading this book, I really see that red thread of historical custody that leads us back to a home video camera. If anybody remembers those that captured the...
They were called camcorders.
I know. Yeah. And I remember holding one as a kid and I was like, this weighs as much as a dying star. Yeah. And this is what captured the horrific beating of Rodney King by four LAPD police officers in 1991. And it sent shockwaves, not just through LA or even the country, but indeed the world. And now your book covers a specific period, a little over a year from the time of the beating to the resignation of LAPD police chief Daryl Gates. But before we discuss those months, and I want to get back to the city charter as well, but could you set the stage here for us, as you do in the book's backstory section, that kind of contextualizes what happened to Rodney King, not so much as aberrant in its occurrence, but aberrant in its documentation?
Well, the context was that starting in the 1930s, the Los Angeles City Charter set up a system that made the Los Angeles Police Department virtually autonomous. What it created was a fiefdom for LAPD chiefs who were virtually unfireable. Certainly the mayor could not fire a police chief. Daryl Gates, who is the Trumpian villain of the story, had been the driver for Chief Parker, William Parker, who wrote that provision in the city charter, and then who was a police chief for, I think, 17 years till he died. And a lot of people felt that Gates was planning on dying on the job too. And with no accountability and a view of people of color, particularly in poor neighborhoods, as really being lesser citizens and not having the same rights, the syndrome for in Black and Latino neighborhoods in Los Angeles was really unimaginable to most middle class and upper class white people. I certainly would have had no idea how the police behaved in those neighborhoods had I not gotten involved with the American Civil Liberties Union in Southern California and learned from the lawyers there that they were getting dozens of complaints every week on a police brutality hotline, and that the Rodney King beating, which Chief Gates quickly called an aberration, was not an aberration at all. It was business as usual, particularly for Blacks who were stopped. Although the rules of the police department said that it's not their job to punish people, they decided to be judge, jury, and administrators of punishment for people that they didn't like. And the aberration was, as you put it, was that it was on video. Home video cameras had just become a mass item where average people could get them. And a guy in an apartment building near where the beating took place heard a noise. He had just gotten this camcorder and he videotaped four LA police officers brutally beating a Black man on the ground with metal batons while 23 other police officers looked on. The Gulf War had just ended 3 days before, and CNN, who had grown to have a global audience based on showing footage from the Gulf War, didn't have anything equally violent to show. So while the videotape would have been newsworthy under any circumstances, it got a tremendous amount of repeat broadcasts on CNN, was picked up by television stations both in the US and, as you said, around the world. I think there was a poll that showed something like 90% of the American public had seen the beating, and an overwhelming majority thought that it was inappropriate. So it changed the political reality on the ground overnight in Los Angeles and gave Mayor Bradley, who was the first Black mayor of Los Angeles, a former LAPD officer himself, someone who was well aware of the racist trends within the police department, who had hated him and Daryl Gates had known and hated each other for 40 years. But Bradley, up until the Rodney King beating, felt he just didn't have the political power to do anything about it. And he saw that with the change in public opinion, he saw an opportunity as the last thing in his legacy. He was going to end 20 years as mayor to change the city charter and to get rid of Gates. It was incredibly hard to do. Gates had a team of 80 cops who surveilled city council members, business leaders, and celebrities, had files on their personal behavior, which could ruin a career. He had a gift as a demagogue for exploiting the fear of crime during a period when there was gang violence in Los Angeles and the crack epidemic was raging. Gates was one of the major national voices in the so-called war on drugs. And in fact, the very day of the Rodney King beating, he'd been honored at the White House by President George H.W. Bush, who called him an American hero. And he had a city charter that created very, very difficult to surmount legal obstacles to his removal. And he had allies in about, you know, a third, 40% of the city, you know, the kind of white grievance, fear of crime, conservative voters who were not sufficient to elect a mayor, but who were very dedicated to supporting him. So it was very hard to get rid of him. And Bradley did a brilliant job of creating kind of a left-center coalition in order to sustain the interest in police reform and to create a politically salient majority to execute it. Typically, these kind of things get a lot of publicity for a week or two and then fade. And then the fear of crime is again up there and other issues dominate the front pages. So it took tremendous amount of conscious effort and planning to keep it in the headlines for over a year. I think there were more than 50 front page stories on the Los Angeles Times about the struggle to get rid of Daryl Gates and to change the LAPD. The LA Times became an ally, really, of the mayor and the other people he assembled. So I've rambled on for a bit, so sorry for the long answer, but that's
not
some
at
of
all.
The context.
I mean, I asked you to contextualize something that you spent like dozens of pages doing, so it's kind of my fault as well. But you know, it's kind of the issue one has when one talks about a book on a 30-minute show. But I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, you talked about the coalition, and I wanted to talk about diversity of tactics here as well.
Yeah.
Because that's something that we talk about on the show. We recently had Kamau Franklin on the show to talk about the diversity of tactics vis-a-vis the Stop Cop City movement.
Yes.
So could you describe some of what you saw while you were also a part of that diversity of tactics?
Yeah.
with regards to that?
Well, let me give one brief other addition to the context to illustrate why Gates was so, as Maxine Waters told me, hated by Black people in Los Angeles. There had been a period in the 80s when 15 men were killed by police chokeholds in LA, 12 of them 80% Black, at a time when the Black population was only 17%. And when Gates was asked if he thought there was at least some unconscious racism in the department, he said no. He believed that the arteries of Black men were different than those of white, of quote unquote, normal people, which even 30 years later, Maxine Waters and LA Mayor Karen Bass, who were around for that beating, were still shaken by the othering and dehumanization of Black people to literally think their biology was that different. The tactics, the overall goal was to create a supermajority of public opinion that was going to be consistently in favor of changing the LAPD and specifically changing the LAPD chief. And that involved several things. One is that Bradley appointed Warren Christopher, who was kind of the leading corporate lawyer, business insider in Los Angeles, also a Democratic Party insider. Christopher would be made the Secretary of State by President Clinton the following year. He asked Christopher to have a commission to study racism and brutality on the LAPD. The underlying reality was certainly known to people like the ACLU and to Bradley himself, but Christopher, by assembling a bipartisan committee, and because of the gravitas that he had with the business community, who was very influential in LA politics, was able to spotlight a pattern of racism and brutality in a way that resonated with white moderates who wouldn't necessarily have believed it if somebody like the ACLU was the only people saying it. Secondly, there was the administrative tactic, which is there was an entity called the Los Angeles Police Commission that was weak and couldn't really fire the chief, but did oversee a lot of budgeting issues, had weekly meetings with the chief, had access to police department information, and he appointed a man named Stanley Sheinbaum to be president of that commission. Sheinbaum was my mentor politically. He'd been a former ACLU chair himself. He was a leading Hollywood liberal. His money had come from marrying Betty Warner, the daughter of one of the Warner brothers. And him and Norman Lear were often referred to as the Malibu Mafia. He did the first fundraiser for Bernie Sanders outside of Vermont when Bernie was running for mayor of Burlington, supported Jesse Jackson. So he was a very atypical person to have a position in city government, but he had money. He was 70 years old. He couldn't be intimidated or blackmailed or bribed. He created tremendous week in and week out pressure on Gates, both to start implementing some reforms and to push him to finally leave. There was also the coalition between Bradley and Maxine Waters, who was a state assembly person who then became a congresswoman. She's still, of course, in the US Congress and was the first person I spoke to when I was writing the book. Bradley and Maxine Waters were on different sides of the Democratic Party. Bradley was a centrist insider, pro-growth business Democrat. Maxine, and forgive me, I've known her for many decades, and she's always let me call her by her first name, had been a co-chair of Jesse Jackson's national campaign. Bradley and Maxine Waters often opposing candidates for city council, but they worked together. They put aside their differences on other issues and worked together. So I think the left-center coalition is central to the success, and a lack of that coalition was central, I think, to a failure at other times trying to deal with this issue. There was also exploitation positively of allies in the media. The media in Los Angeles saw that video and really became part of the solution and helped keeping the drumbeat going. There was also the creative community. You know, it wasn't only poor drunk drivers like Rodney King who were racially profiled in essence, or certainly treated differently because they were black. Joe Morgan, a Hall of Fame baseball player, had been pulled over and thrown to the ground by the LAPD at the LA airport. Jamal Wilkes, who a basketball NBA star, Wesley Snipes and other LA actors all had stories. And of course, the early 90s saw the emergence of a kind of hip hop that was called by the media gangster rap. The most famous song that came out of that in the late 80s, early 90s was F the Police by the group N with Attitude. And of course, I took my title Liberals with Attitude as kind of an homage to that. That sold millions of records, even though it was never played on the radio. And it wasn't about the police in general. It was about the LAPD specifically. There were more than a dozen lyrics that name-checked Daryl Gates specifically. That's how notorious a figure he was. And so that kind of activity kept what we would today call the base active, while people like Warren Christopher were dealing with the business community, the media was dealing with the kind of moderates who cared with it. And it was the combination of those tactics and the willingness of people on the left and the center to focus on the single issue of changing the city charter and getting rid of Gates that created a success. And I think that's what's a relevant example for the situation today. Tom Bradley's really showed how to do it in a way that few political leaders have been able to pull it off and actually execute change, not just protest.
I just want to remind our listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio, and I'm your co-host, Eleanor Goldfield, and we are speaking with author Danny Goldberg about his new book, Liberals with Attitude, The Rodney King Beating and the Fight for the Soul of Los Angeles. I wanted to ask you about that because in reading your book, I see, of course, many echoes of today, but I also see something that's very different because the Democrats have moved further and further right since I was born. I mean, I would not consider myself a liberal. I'm very much in line with Phil Oakes' song, Love Me, I'm a Liberal. And in my experience with working and organizing with liberals, they're more likely to acquiesce to the far right than to the actual left. But I also believe in organizing that is uncomfortable. So I think that there's nuance there, but there's this constant demand on like the left, the organizing left, the grassroots left. You know, you got to calm down and play nice with the corporate Democrats that keep moving right. You know, it's like you're chasing after them and come back over here. And they're like, no, we're going to go further right. So I'm curious how you have perceived that since the early 90s or late 80s, and how you think that coalition building can realistically happen in today's very divisive, but also like the Overton window having shifted so far to the right.
You know, it's funny, Stanley Scheinbaum, who I mentioned before, had written a lot and talked a lot in 1986. That was kind of when congressional Democrats, there was a guy that was part of the fundraising committee or something named Tony Coelho, who's also in the House, decided to go after corporate contributions. And that he saw that very much as an inflection point and predicted that that greater fealty to big donors was going to distort Democratic Party. So it's a subject matter that I've certainly been thinking about even since then, because he was so obsessed with it. I think that the interesting thing about the story that I tell is that the leadership came from a business Democrat, a centrist. Bradley was a forerunner of corporate Democrats. He was Black, so he was much more attuned to racial prejudice and issues. But on economic issues, he was the middle of the roader. He didn't support Jesse Jackson. Like, again, Maxine Waters and him often fought about these sorts of things. But he understood that on certain issues, he could only accomplish what he wanted by respecting and fully making the left a partner. Obviously, in New York City, where I'm currently sitting, the mayoral race is an example of the need for mainstream Democrats who don't necessarily identify with the Bernie Sanders, AOC, Mamdani part of the party to recognize that Mamdani won a Democratic primary. And I think how these New York-based national congressional leaders end up behaving in the next few weeks is going to have a lot of impact on the credibility of mainstream Democrats when they try to create coalitions in other elections and other contexts. You know, the same tension was true between corporate Dems and true progressives in the early 90s as is now. That's not something, the Overton window has moved to the right. But it was already moving to the right then. There was in the shadow of 8 years of the Reagan presidency and a philosophy among Democrats to focus more and more on big donors. And the challenge for progressives is to have enough power through constituencies that they're essential for coalitions. That was something that people like the ACLU and Maxine Waters were able to do in LA, where they may not have controlled a majority of the city, but they controlled an indispensable portion of any coalition that could beat people like Daryl Gates, who was very similar to Donald Trump in many ways. So, you know, I think that hopefully Bradley is somebody that today's moderates will study and realize that they've got to be honored the fact that a coalition really means mutual respect, not just telling people on the left to salute.
Which is really all I've ever heard from the Democrats, to be honest. But I wanted to also ask you, because you're very honest in the book about this didn't fix everything, because nothing does.
Oh my God, of course not.
Well, right. And I think this is also an issue with, I mean, I run into this a lot in mutual aid organizing and community organizing, like, well, this won't fix everything. And I'm like, yeah, nothing will, because I'm not God.
Yeah, right.
But there is there's this issue of this question that has, you know, popped up after the 2020 George Floyd uprisings that hit, you know, across the country. I was in D.C. for that, which was who gets to police the police? And of course, now, you know, in D.C., you see Trump saying, well, they're my police, which is obviously not the direction that I think the majority of Americans want to go. But it is a question, like in the city charter that you would describe in the book as well, discusses this. But if the police are accountable to the people in power, then they can't possibly be accountable to the people. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the aftermath after Gates left. How did it look after that with regards to police reform in Los Angeles? And how did that then, did it stick? What do we see now in Los Angeles? I mean, there's another battle for the soul of Los Angeles, or there has been recently. So how do you see this kind of echoing still today?
Well, there were certain things that definitely got better and a lot of things that didn't get better. because it was never rational to assume that just changing police chiefs and changing the structure of the city charter was going to change all of the inherent problems in virtually all governments, but certainly in the U.S. system. But there were some tangible improvements. You know, I quote Connie Rice, who was the head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and deeply involved with police reform over a long period of time, including after the Gates thing, where she just fixated at one point on the way they were using police dogs, which this was another one of those things where a lot of police departments around the country would use police dogs, but the ratio of dog bites was like way more in Los Angeles than any other city. And when I say any other city, I'm including cities like Chicago and Detroit and New York that don't have, especially at that time, like super progressive police departments, but just were kind of normal compared to the extreme version in LA. And that she found that by engaging with police officers and letting them suggest how to train the dogs differently, that they had they reduced dog bites by 80 or 90%, and that stuck, that did last. So it sounds like, well, that's a pretty superficial thing, but if you're the person who didn't get bit by a dog, it's a good thing, you know. So there was at least some level of accountability. I mean, you're saying, well, they're only accountable to people in power, but, you know, it's a question is who's in power? And it's a better situation, as far as we can tell, when at least there's some separation of powers. Like the elected city government is not perfect. Karen Bass, though, who is the mayor, came out of the police reform movement. She was a member of police reform groups back in the late 80s. Not that the mayor of Los Angeles has that much power. It's by design decentralized between the LA County Board of Supervisors and the city council and business and state and the national. But, you know, I'd rather have her have some influence over the police chief than none, you know, and it's all incremental. The George Floyd example, you know, the national law that was proposed and which couldn't overcome the hurdle of the filibuster in the Senate was not a radical law, but it did, for example, because it was a compromise that involved, you know, Tim Scott, the Republican senator from South Carolina and so on. But it, for example, would have had a database where if a police officer was fired in one city for brutality and then he applies for a job 500 miles away in another police department, that data that they would immediately know, oh, well, that's why he was fired. Even such an obvious common sense reform like that wouldn't get approved by enough Republicans for it to become law. I don't know if anything would have made any difference given the weirdness of the federal government in the Trump era and the way that Republicans are so supplicant to the most racist part of their base. But a narrower focus on specific goals, I think, has a better chance of success than just general angst about racism, because it's just not that easy to create political action in this system. We have a very flawed system. The majority doesn't always rule. You really need super majorities to move the needle if you're going up against entrenched interests. It is amazing. Absolutely nothing changed on a national level in terms of the laws about policing. I don't know always that mass demonstrations are the best tactic. I think sometimes they're the right tactic, sometimes they're not. There were certainly demonstrations connected to Rodney King, but it was always part of a strategy. But we had leadership in LA that was really effective and committed, and the leadership in the country was more fragmented post-George Floyd. I'm not saying it was that easy to do, but we, you know, got to learn what works and what doesn't work. What matters is having less people beaten up and having less people shot, having less people incarcerated wrongly, not making a rhetorical point.
Performative protests are, they can be fun for Instagram, but they don't really do much. And I say that as somebody who organizes.
Listen, I remember, I'm old enough to have gone to anti-war protests during the Vietnam War. And I never thought that everybody at those protests was that well-versed on the underlying issues of which the Vietnamese government, it becomes a social occasion. It becomes identifying with the group. And again, there is examples where these things have been very effective. And there have been examples where they've been counterproductive. And I just think, you know, if you're going to be goal-oriented, you've got to have a rational assessment each time.
Danny, thank you so much. Folks, check out Liberals with Attitude, The Rondi King Beating and the Fight for the Soul of Los Angeles, put out by Akashic Books. Danny Goldberg, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us
talk
about your work.
For letting you talk about the book. Bye-bye.
We want to smash, crash, bash, mash, blast the system. We want to get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, this pumping rhythm is hitting. We want to make it clear, we ain't scared, this is the vision.
That does it for another episode of the Project Censored Radio Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your producer and co-host, Eleanor Goldfield, along with my co-host and executive producer, Mickey Huff. For more information about all the things that the project does, from the classroom to the radio waves, please check out projectcensored.org. I'd also like to remind listeners that the views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Project Censored. This broadcast is intended for educational purposes as part of our mission to promote critical media literacy, independent journalism, and civic engagement. We aim to foster thoughtful dialogue and encourage listeners to think critically about the information that they receive from all media sources. Project Censored is a 501c3 nonprofit organization and does not endorse or oppose any candidate for public office. We have a lot of tools, resources, and information over at our website. Again, that's projectcensored.org. Please also follow us on social media at Project Censored. As always, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons filled with capacity citizens, and the times for the master thief. Combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love of lift our brothers and our sisters.
This is David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Do you love rock and roll? Then tune in to KBOO every Friday afternoon at 3 for the Roots of Rock and Roll. Join 45-year